Welcome back to Emerge, y'all. On this episode, I'm speaking with James Cerwillo. James is the author of the book Metamodern Leadership, which is a survey of history, economics, philosophy, and politics, and all the various ingredients that have taken us to this moment in time. And specifically, it's a look into the value sets and value memes that might characterize the millennial generation, which within his model, or this Strauss Howe model that James uses, the millennials would be characterized as the civic or heroic generation, with symmetries going back to the greatest generation. And I really appreciate this archetype or this metaphor, and really this invitation to see the millennial generation, of whom I am one for sure, as being a generation that is stepping into a position of duty and a responsibility vis-a-vis the current state of the world and the opportunity to meet the challenges of our time in a way that might characterize our generation. I think that's a really beautiful thought. And so this is a conversation about leadership, about millennials, and about how to conceive of ourselves in this time that we're in. As always, if you enjoy Emerge, if you'd like to support this project, you can do so in two ways, I'll say today, two ways. One is by leaving a review on iTunes or whatever other platform you can leave reviews on. Those reviews really help people discover the show. Or you can support more directly with a financial contribution. You can make a monthly backing donation of 99 cents, $4, or $10, and that will go to help maintain the digital infrastructure of the show, as well as making it so that I can spend more time doing research and production for each episode. Okay, well, without further ado, please enjoy this episode of Emerge with James Cerwillo. Welcome back to another episode of Emerge. This time on the show, my guest is James Cerwillo. And I first heard about James's work, I guess I should say your work, I've been speaking to you now, through the writing of Brent Cooper on Medium. He wrote an article called On Metamodern Leadership, How Millennials Will Change the World. And like so many things that I find in this kind of metamodern subculture, I felt like there was a way that words were being put to ideas and sensibilities that I had been feeling for a long time, for many years. And after reading that post, I picked up your book, Metamodern Leadership, and found it to be a kind of wonderful tour of philosophical, political, and cultural history. In my mind, I think of it kind of like a more secular and honestly grounded version of like Ken Wilber's Brief History of Everything, you know, just in the way that it was this kind of survey, had this quality of like, oh yeah, like, and it reminded me because I studied philosophy in college. I was like, oh yeah, okay, I remember all these philosophers and okay, this is the time that we're in. And I found that your book gave a really good sense of context to our current kind of time that we're on this planet, you know, this time of now with the rise of the millennials as a kind of active class or generation in our culture. And so really excited to have you on, James, to talk about, you know, the Strauss Howe generational theory, millennials, leadership, and metamodernism. So welcome to the show, James.
All right, Dana, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yeah, I just start off here. I took it from Foucault, his sort of idea of the history of the present. And I know we've discussed this before in past talks is, you know, what does it mean to be here in the now and looking back, you know, what what can we learn from history, which is a question that we always have. But looking back on the philosophical history, what's the history of the millennial generation in particular, and the especially within the past year, listen to philosophers such as Hansi Franek. What's the era of metamodernism in general? What does it mean? So I really want to start talking about generational theory, generational history, that is. The Strauss-Howe theory, I don't know if a lot of people have heard about that. I know you'll see it in articles from time to time.
Yeah.
It's this idea, this great theory, very unscientific, yet it makes a lot of sense. It says that, a generation is roughly 20 years, which we could all agree on. And there are cycles of generations going back in American history since basically the 16th century. And the crux of this theory is that there are four generational archetypes that keep repeating in an 80-year cycle, which kind of makes sense because you have, a saeculum, which is what the ancient Etruscans called this sort of magical period that makes up a human life. It's four generations long, essentially. So Strauss and Howe seem to pick up something magical about these 80-year periods, and specifically these 20-year periods, especially within the 20th century. And, today we define them as the baby boomer generation, the millennial generation, Gen X. We kind of have an idea what this is, but where do they come from, and right. where are they going? Right. So that's kind of the big idea.
Yeah, and so it's this really interesting way of, I think, as you mentioned, Foucault, of kind of like deconstructing how it is that generations form their sort of unique identities and value sets and sort of perspective on the world. And so, how does this generational theory help us understand, what's going on now and the metamodern era that we seem to be moving into?
Sure. Well, there was a guy who was kind of a pitch man, kind of an odd guy, like in the 70s and 80s. His name was Morris Massey. I think he was kind of a sociology professor, and he became kind of a pitch man, exactly what you think if you ever go back and watch his videos, what you think a pitch man would be. And he said things like, what you are now is what you were then. Something like that. And, so he kind of goes back and this is really getting into the sociology of all this is, how did events in your life shape you? I mean, just look at the financial crash in, 2008. A lot of people say, hey, millennials are 18 in 2008 for the most part, pretty much the average age. So how does that affect your life when you're getting ready to go to college, you're getting ready to start your life, and you just had the greatest financial crash in a saeculum, 80 years. So Strauss and Howe would say that that's not a coincidence, that, having 80 years roughly between such catastrophic events is basically this sort of magical value structure playing out throughout the years, because there's going to be and inevitabilities within these cycles. So it's a little strange. It's a little metaphysical. But it's a nice idea to understand that, the idea of value structures changing. I mean, we've known this. I mean, there's lots of, the Greeks, they said this, that, hey, exactly what they said about Socrates. They said, hey, he's ruining the values of youth. All the young people follow them, and they said, hey, this is, the value structures are going to hell, and we don't know what to make of the future. So this is nothing new. This is 2,000 or 3,000 years old at least.
And there's also in this theory, there's kind of like symmetries to be drawn out between generations in the past. Seculum, right? So like symmetrical with or parallel with millennials is it the silent generation, or which is the prior generation that kind of occupied the same archetype?
Actually, yeah, it's the greatest generation. Yeah, it's the greatest generation. The civic generation. You know, they're kind of archetypically the ones that come and rescue. They're the heroes.
Mm.
So you have an idealist generation, which are the boomers. Obviously, I mean, they're the ones responsible for the social revolutions of the 1960s.
Right.
When they were young. I mean, they're the largest generation in American history until the millennials, right? So pretty much everything about American culture currently is shaped by the baby boomer generation. And the only generation that's larger is the millennial generation. A lot of this understanding is that, hey, let's look at the demographics of all this. Within the next decade, 3/4 of the world population are going to be millennials. Mm. Baby boomers within 5 years or so, you know, you're probably talking 60-70% are going to be retirement eligible, or retired. And that's going to leave a vacuum for these millennial values and these structures that they're setting up that people, a lot of people don't necessarily find appealing or think that that's a good thing. So that's where you get into the sort of the political battles in not only in culture, but in politics.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things that I appreciated about having this theory or this kind of map of the archetypical evolution of generations, or however you want to describe it, is that it kind of helped me step outside of my context a little bit and get a sense of like the arc of history, such that I saw like, oh, okay, like generations ascend into their power and then they leave, and there's a next generation who comes up and sort of like takes the baton and plays a certain role in the unfolding of civilization. And so maybe like, could you paint a kind of picture, like what is the kind of archetypical move, right, of these different generations? So there's the hero, there's the crisis. I don't exactly remember which, but could you unfold that a little bit?
Yeah, there's a prophet generation, which is essentially the idealist of the boomer generation. Mm. There's the reactive or the nomad, which would be the silent generation or generation Z. Mm. They're the same archetype. And then the civic generation or the hero, that is the millennial generation / the greatest generation.
Mm. What about Gen X?
Gen X is the reactive generation or the nomad. Uh-huh. So they're kind of the ones that are kind of out there lost in space, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that makes perfect sense. Because you look at it, now we're going to get into sort of cultural eras. And if anybody isn't familiar with the term postmodernism, Gen X is pretty much parallel with the postmodern world. And I can take us through that in a second. I'm sure a lot of people understand that idea, but you know, it's full of cynicism and nihilism, and it's a like a living, breathing Simpsons, you know, where you don't know what to believe. You grow, if you're a Gen Xer, which means you're probably born, you know, after 1965 or so. You had been a little kid, and you would have seen the president resign. So you lose faith in your leaders. You have an existential crisis in the 1970s where, you know, you have stagflation and you're not sure about the economy or you know, what's going to happen in the world. Is there going to be a nuclear war? You're not even sure about the industrial economy. I mean, they saw their parents having a pretty cushy life, with a lot of you know, it, you know, United States in from the 19, you know, from the 19 late 1930s through the end of the 60s was a pretty liberal with a capital L society. And there's a lot of equality. But then again, you get into postmodernism and you realize that there's a lot of people that were sort of ostracized from that equality. So now you're talking about, you know, gay rights, African-American rights, women's rights, you know, what did colonialization do to, so that's where you get into the postmodern and sort of deconstruction of culture. And you start to question everything in the modern world, the whole modern project, starting from the, you know, the 17th century on. So it's like, you know, the whole world, you know, and all the structures, you knew, and all the axioms that you have come to know, you start to question right in the middle of the 1970s. And this is really kind of, like I said, it's an existential crisis for Gen Xers. So they got to, what are they going to do? They got to, you got to be nihilistic, or you got to be cynical to kind of, you got to be tough. So you got to form some sort of shield. So it really kind of changes your perception and your being. So I, that's why I really get into, this, the idea of metamodernism, because it's like, that's going to lead you to a dead end. Eventually you gotta synthesize that modern project where you had, you know, you're reaching for progress. You can't deconstruct everything until you, you know, everything becomes relativistic and you're not sure what to believe, because, you know, it sure makes things a lot better when you can believe in something.
Right. And, well, and there's a way in which, you know, we couldn't move into metamodernism or whatever the post-postmodern era is without first doing this kind of nihilistic deconstruction. Like, that was necessary. And we can imagine, like, in the previous 80-year cycle, that another generation performed a kind of relatively similar role in the relationship between the different generations, and that this is a kind of like reoccurrence, right? And for me, that kind of gives me a level of optimism, yeah, that we're kind of ensconced in a larger movement of kind of history. But in any case, like so the kind of, and you're a perfect person, James, because you kind of sit or to talk about this, because you sit in between Gen X and the millennials. Yeah, you're you kind of are between the two generational eras.
Yeah, I was born in 1979, so I've, you know, not that I've really ever looked at myself as being part of a generation, because most people don't, but and definitely in the past decade or so we've started to do that more than we had in the past. But yeah, I mean, usually there's rough periods where you're going to, you know, usually the Gen X 1965 to 1979, 1980, right around there. And then millennials are 1980, 81, 82 to maybe 97, maybe 2000. So it's definitely, there's definitely a transitional sort of period right there where you're kind of straddling two generations and you're trying to, you know, who do you identify with?
Well, that tension probably kind of positions you to understand this inflection point that we're moving into now, I think, in a unique way, compared to a lot of the folks who I think are participating in, like myself, are like straight up millennials, you know, like I'm 30 years old. So it's,
yeah,
like,
sure.
That's the world I was born into is exerting the pressures, like September 11th and all those things, in the way that it does. And so I guess it might be interesting then to, so we have Gen X, who kind of are an expression of the postmodern move of deconstruction and, you know, maybe even nihilism, and, you know, we can look at like punk rock and you know, all the cultural trappings that were produced then. But now we're moving into the metamodern era, and maybe could you describe a little bit about like the emergence of this value set?
My book is really, when I wrote it, I intended to be regarding somebody to sort of make sense out of what they need to do personally and especially professionally, really. So it's, you know, oddly enough, this is a business book. It's got almost nothing about business in it. I mean, there's a couple mm-hmm. chapters that really relate to capitalism and to leadership. And I think it makes a lot of sense once you put it all together. But, you know, participation, you know, sort of, it's a whole different world. There's new power structures that require you to just kind of put things out there. We'll start mm-hmm. with that. I mean, you know, if let's say let's look at my dad. My dad graduated from high school in 1974, I believe. And he had two jobs. You know, on Monday, he had two jobs that he was ready to go to. He had to pick one.
Hmm.
You know, there's no college education. And there are good jobs. My dad's retired from a very good job. And it's great with the pension. And, you know, good for him. That's the way the world worked now, then, mm-hmm. you know, so what do you have to do if you're a millennial? Well, you're going to have to, you're probably gonna have to go to college because you make 56% more, by going to college. However, you're going to have a huge bill, mm-hmm. At the end of college. So does it make sense? Well, I don't know. I mean, if you're trying to increase your odds of you know, not having to scrape by in your life, it sure makes sense. What else do you want out of college? It's not necessarily a financial pursuit, and in fact, it was never intended to be a financial pursuit. Not until the 1980s, which is when the millennials were children, did we really sort of start to maximize the profit end of college in general. I mean, and even in the '70s, you could go to college for, you know, you could, I think Bill O'Reilly said this a lot. Oh, I worked my way through college in the 1960s or the 1970s by getting a summer job. It's like, well, yeah, because it costs $600.
Right.
You know, I mean, you could do that then. It's apples and oranges. You know, college costs a lot of money. And it's not just that. There's no pensions. There's high housing costs. There's you know, there's no guarantee for Social Security. In fact, I believe, you know, in the United States, Social Security is going to become insolvent in 2033. That is probably going to be the biggest economic political fight of the millennials' lives. So, and I don't expect that fight to start for 7, 8 years, 9 years, when people really start to realize that, hey, we're going to have a new social contract, because we've paid for everybody's Social Security up until 2033. What's everybody going to do? In 2033, my youngest daughter will be 21 years old. She'll be just about to enter the workforce. What's going to be her reality?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, I see this in my own family. Like my sisters are more Gen Xers. And so they do have this kind of nihilistic streak, I think. But my mother, I see that she had attempted to a kind of apply the story by which her life followed, which is a very typical, like, kind of, I think, go to college, you know, become a professor, become a tenure professor. And like, there is this kind of journey that worked for her, it worked for my father, it worked for, I guess, people in their generation. And I think for many years, she kind of, she felt that it was strange that I didn't follow that narrative trajectory with my life. And now I think only now that we're kind of more in the muck of it, you know, more like deeper into this new change in the eras, is she like, oh damn, like things are very different for you, aren't they? You know, and I think it's helpful to reflect on how different things are, right? And so, yeah, this topic of like, you know, just the economic opportunities, the landscape of economic opportunities is clearly very different. And then there's this an issue that we talked a little bit about before the call of like the technological landscape. Maybe do you want to kind of talk a little bit about that?
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's exactly where I was going. It hasn't been 20 years since we've really hit a digital revolution. I mean, we've pretty much digitized every single thing there is. We've codified everything digitally. You know, the worldview was analog until 17, 18, you know, and now I believe it's over 99% of every information is coded digitally. You know, we talk, and especially in politics today, in the United States at least, we talk about, you know, offshoring, outsourcing, bringing jobs back to the United States. And okay, you know, that's fine. Automation, and everybody knows this, automation is tenfold more important, if you're going to talk about jobs, than bring a, you know, a few hundred or a few thousand jobs back. I mean, we're talking about killing millions, tens of millions of jobs, and what's going to be in their place. You know, what are the jobs so it seems pretty logical. Okay, well, I'll go out and get a STEM degree, and I'll know something about engineering and about mathematics and about technology and about science, and mm-hmm. I'll build my own niche out here, that'll be my career. It'll be pretty similar to the way it was in the past. Well, you know, what happens in 20 years what happens when it technology is going to revolutionize everything again and again. In fact, a great example, and here's how deep it goes. I don't think you can really describe how deep it is. And I didn't really understand this until I just read, I don't know if anybody's familiar with, I hope I don't butcher his name, Yuval Noah Harari.
Oh, Yuval Noah Harari. I'm working my way through the 21 yeah. Lessons book or the, yeah.
Okay, good, yeah. Good. I just got through the Homo Deus.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a trip.
that's his prior book. And, it's, you know, it's a developmental book, and I can get into the sort of the developmental theories and ideas, but, kind of what he's saying is that, you know, we're entering an era very soon, and we probably have already kind of dipped our toes in it, where, you know, for the past 300 or 400 years, we were humanistic. We've kind of turned, you know, after the Middle Ages, and we had kind of a death of God, as Nietzsche said. We saw that humans were the ones building things, and we were the ones doing things, and we were the ones materialistically transforming the world. I mean, if you go look at any graph after the year about 1890, you'll see that by any measure of any human progress, I mean, things just start getting exponential, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all due to technology, and specifically due to communication technology. And as you sort of move along that path, humans matter a little less and a little less. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. And although we're still firmly humanistic, we believe in that, you know, the deep idea that we have knowledge and values that make us sort of almost godlike. We understand right from wrong, essentially, is really what it comes down to. That's what the founders of the US and the Enlightenment said about natural rights. That's what natural rights are. There's natural things that go on in the world. Same thing that the Stoic philosophers in ancient Rome thought. There's things that are natural in the world that humans know and can sense. Well, what happens when you get to a point, and you could start out with the behavioral economics of like Kahneman or something, and it says, well, hey, you know, maybe humans, there's a lot that we don't know about other people, and there's a lot that we don't know about ourselves. And is when you start handing over bits and pieces of that humanistic idea, and you're kind of uploading yourself into technology, which is exactly what we do in Facebook. Mm-hmm. You know, the more likes, the more you interact with technology, the more technology knows about you. So in turn, not only does technology know more about you than everybody you know, but it knows more about you than you know about yourself. And then eventually you have such a connection with technology that it becomes almost godlike. And I mean that literally. And that's pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's scary, but it's also, it's you know, whether or not you buy the where it's going, like the kind of end state of the trajectory, mm-hmm. it's clearly like very, very different, right? The kind of ecology in which humans grow up and become adults, mm-hmm. move into adulthood is just so radically different. You know, not even speaking about future algorithmic situations that are very problematic, but even just right now, like the way in which Facebook is sort of refactoring our consciousness is, whether you think it's alarming or not, it's certainly significant, and it's kind of contributing to a shift, I think, in value sets that is typical of the sort of millennial mind or millennial person in our culture. And so, you know, we talked a little bit about this too ahead of the call, like, you know, this you said quite well, I think, what the plight is of the millennial, at least how I experience it often, is like, I look at a future that is just exponentially weird and different, and I'm like, how do I prepare myself for that? Like, it seems very difficult to kind of get a handle on. And at the same time, I feel like our culture is often sort of talking down about millennials. Like, they're kind of just mm-hmm. say, like, I think I read an article that, like, millennials just, you know, the list of industries that millennials have quote unquote killed is very long. and I think that I read an article like just last week. It was like, millennials have now killed American cheese. And it's just like, well, what, what does that even mean? Right?
Yeah. Like, so, what else will they kill? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, there's going to be a value structure that progresses that, so, you know, I've kind of talked about the cyclical ideas of values for, mm-hmm. for generations, but, you know, that's just a sliver of the real issue here. And kind of going back to modernism and to postmodernism and to what's next, you know, you can take this thing all the way back, which I do. So it's kind of a history book as well. And it says that, well, you know, you have an animistic society of hunter gatherers that, you know, live in nature. And then 10,000 or 12,000 years ago, you have we get into culture, and then you start to codify these stories across time. As you get, you know, about 2,000 or 3,000 years ago into some sort of formalized religion. And then basically what are the Middle Ages, but the lived sort of structure that came out of these writings, you know, across the world all at the same time, you know, Lao Tzu and Confucius and Buddha and Plato and Jesus and Christianity. And this happened kind of simultaneously because it's sort of almost like an order of nature. So you've got this sort of biologic, technological progression that happens all the way through. So you're talking about, you know, the printing press really stopped the Middle Ages, right? When Martin Luther nailed the thesis on the wall and said, hey, you know, you guys are, you know, and everybody could read it. You know, once you can read, you sort of take the power away from the clergy, and then everybody starts to kind of start their own religion, not necessarily religion, but their own interpretation of religion, right? And then, then you get into the modern world, and you have, you know, the invention in the late modernism and in the industrial period, you have, you know, the photograph and the radio and the motion picture and the television. And then you have the you know, the internet, and these things are progressing, and you're having to, you know, the Hanzi and the listening society calls them stages. You have to interpret these. It's sort of like your software. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you're born in a certain time, you take a software update, right? So you have a software and a hardware. And and that kind of does go hand in hand with the cyclical idea, but you gotta have a dialectic, you know, it's kind of a synthesis of the ideas that there's cycles as well as there's ultimate progress. Mm. And, you know, you need to understand where that's going to take, you know, a value structure.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. And so one of the pieces of the book and the generational theory in particular that really resonated with me was this idea of the millennial generation being the hero archetype, which, you know, mm-hmm. one of the main themes of this show really is the sort of like existential situation that humanity finds itself in. And millennials, it seems, more so than say the baby boomers, don't feel like we can sort of abstract ourselves from it. Like it seems to be more present in our consciousness to a much greater degree than previous generations. And so I love the idea, the possibility of imagining the millennial generation as it unfolds as being this kind of like heroic generation. I wonder if you could say more about that.
Yeah, sure. I like that idea as well. And I think there's something true in it. Here's what I'll say about that. I think, you know, the idea of being a civic archetype or a hero archetype generation is the fact that you're going to do your duty, right? That's what the GI generation did, what the Greatest Generation did, is they went and they fought and they did their duty, you know, what was expected out of them, essentially. So, you know, you don't have, they're not baby boomers. There's not going to be a massive cultural fight. I mean, you know, Occupy is a great example of that type of thing that happened. Although, you know, it didn't really last and it didn't really pick up steam. So they're going to fight in a more, I guess you'd call it more civilized way, or they're going to be a little bit more camouflaged. They're going to kind of fight from the inside out, maybe more than the baby boomers revolted and rebelled. Mm. So, you know, what they're going to do is change the game from the inside. Mm. is how I see it happening. And you know, so I take this to sort of map on top of, you know, everything that the metamodern ideas stand for are neo-Piagetian developmental models. And what that means is that after Piaget, who kind of said that you have four stages as a child, as you become an adult, these neo-Piagetians said, well, listen, you can develop as an adult as well. So that's kind of how far we've come in just the 80 years or so since Piaget did his work. Mm. I mean, you have like a Claire Graves who talked about social development. Jane Levinger was, you know, talking about ego development. Michael Commons talked about cognitive development. So there's all these people that are working in different disciplines that are talking about abstractly pretty much the same thing. So because I'm interested personally in the idea of leadership and sort of the power structures, how things kind of get done, there's a guy named Bill Torbert, who's a professor, and he's got a developmental leadership model who and he talks about the progression of leadership and the developmental framework. And he says that, you know, basically about half of leaders never get, and this is extensive studies done over decades, mm-hmm. half of leaders never get to there's seven stages, never get to the fifth stage of leadership. So the idea to me is that millennials have the capacity and the ability to get to these higher stages of leadership to really do some transformational change. And I think that's where I don't know if we'll call it the baby boomers, the Generation X, or maybe it's not their fault. Maybe it was just culture, or it's culture of business. You know, a lot of my book too is a critique of the leadership industry itself. And really over the past 40 years or so, the idea has been to make experts, which is number three on the stages of Torbert, make experts into achievers. So, and what you're doing there is you're getting somebody who's good at their job and you're making them a leader, and you're saying, okay, let's look at this little departmental framework and let's do good at this. And it's like, okay, well, we can do that. We can do that. But there's no spirituality in it. Mm-hmm. There's no, if you go back to like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, there's no self-actualization in it for the most part. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what, as you develop, that's what millennials are looking for is, you know, what's the next project? What's our next human project? It's to do something, right? So how do you interpret that in terms of leadership and in terms of, you know, just getting up and going to work? How's that gonna change? So what you do is you become a more developed person and a more developed leader. And I think that the millennial generation has that capability to sort of change from within. And mm-hmm. I'll go back here and I'll try to wrap this up. Some of the ideas out of Piaget, who is this original kind of developmentalist, you would call him. He sort of said, what do you do as a child? First of all, you got to learn the rules of the game. So first rule is, you know, get in touch with yourself. And I mean that as a baby, you know, you learned to suck your thumb to soothe yourself. You learn where your fingers and toes are. And then you learn to play with another kid. Then you learn to play with a group of other kids, and you learn the rules of the games. And then you know, if you play those games right, then you get invited to play in other games. And then you try to master the games that you're good at. Mm-hmm. And then once you master the game, then and only then can you start to change the game. So that sort of correlates to the fifth stage of the Torbert model, where, you know, in Wilberian terms, you know, you call it like second tier, right? Where you get this sort of this next level of leadership or of consciousness, or however you want to call it. And, you know, only 15% leaders ever get to be an individualist or a strategist or somewhere along those lines. And I think that, you know, and you get there by things like meditation, Tai Chi, reading philosophy, reflecting, writing, playing music. I mean, nice. You know, cause it's deeper, right? It's not, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I think, so one thing that came up for me as you were speaking is something that this person I read online, David Chapman, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he has this developmental model. He uses Keegan's model and talks about how often people try to kind of skip the mastery of systems now, because postmodernism is a kind of cultural phase. So there's a people are inclined to sort of act as if postmodernism before they actually appropriately go through modernism, right? Through like learning to master a system, master a game. And so they have to kind of go back and learn a system or learn, you know, I guess in maybe more like self or spiritual scenes, you'd say like integrate your shadow of those particular yes. stages. And, you know, I notice what an impact going to the monastery had on me, because there was a place that you were held to a very rigid system. And that was actually, I think, a lot of the benefit. Sure, we got to like sit a lot, but I had never been held to a system that I could believe in, because like most of the systems I've participated in have been like super lame, you know, like the education system is obviously lame, yeah. Like, you know, the jobs that I had been often lame, and just like, you know, so this was a really helpful, I think, for me, so that I could start to understand more, I think, that what's on offer in the next stage, because otherwise it was sort of like I was looking in more so. And I don't know, it's an interesting tension there, because I think that there is this propensity in our culture to I think attempt to kind of skip that stage. I don't know. Do you, is that something that you see and agree with and are concerned about?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what you're talking about there is exactly why Jordan Peterson is, right. you know, so popular now. Is he's telling millennials about things that happened and these traditional structures that people found truths in for thousands of years,
right?
That they never really saw. It's like, well, this is what everybody believed forever, and you know, his kind of thing is the oldest truth is usually the thing that's most right, which is why he's, you know, a conservative. It's that's, you know, you can think of that in political terms if you want. You don't have to. I prefer not to, but. Yeah, yes. Sure. There's truths out there that are old and, you know, axiomatic in terms of, you know, how things present themselves today. And if you're not familiar with that, it's going to seem not real. And you're going to, you know, in his terms, you're going to be pathological. You're not going to understand.
Yeah, then that reminds me also of Robert Keegan's book In Over Our Heads, about the kind of differential between our own development and the kind of development of the culture, and how the difference between that can be very challenging to live through. And it also, again, the thing I'm struck by is like the monastery that I lived in was both training us in meditation, but also teaching us how to be kind of effective actors of systems change. It was a modern monastery. We called it Awakening and Responsibility. And in that way, it was a kind of embodiment of the, what's on the cover of your book, which is, you know, somebody looking backwards and forwards, right? So it's this kind of like, and I think that's maybe what Jordan Peterson doesn't do quite as well, is like integrate this, a very important understanding of the power and role of like ancient technologies of, you know, whether there be monasteries or religion, but integrating that with like the fact that we're on an exponential, you know, existential playing field in a way that we haven't been, that these ancient technologies, the situation they're formulated in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the archetypal hero's journey that he talks about a lot as well, it's, well, that's really, that's going through these stages, you know, individually. There's sort of a hero's journey as you climb the stages of development, right? Every time you're going to sort of break apart all your axioms, all your understanding of the past, and you need to put things back together again. You know, the chaos and order story, you know. I agree with you. There's not enough credence to the emerging structures that seem just as real, especially for young people, always as the ones that happened, that already happened in the past. In fact, they're more real.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And so I think what would be cool then maybe is to describe a little bit more about this stage five leadership? Because I think the other point, maybe it's made in the article, maybe you make it in the book, that is made is that, you know, the nature of our existential situation is that we have to start to create interdisciplinary solutions, like kind of almost impossible innovations that would only be possible if we started to like practice, it seems, this kind of more sophisticated form of leadership. And so could you describe that kind of leadership? Like, what is it like? And then, give us a little more sense of it.
Yeah, well, start at the beginning here. Like, conventional leader is somebody who's completely, you know, basically an ego that's not interested in anybody else but themselves. So we hope that we never run into a leader like that. The next stage, and this is exactly what you were saying about, you know, the same thing applies to postmodernism. You have to go through postmodernism. You have to go through the modern world to get to metamodernism. You know, you can't skip these ideas. It's the same thing as developing as a child in Piagetian terms. So you have an expert, and that's where most people exist for their life. 38% of people, and this is what Torberg found. They're logical, precise, consensus building, rational, efficient. You know, these are, if you want to be good at your job, you want to be an expert, sure. And that's great. So what the leadership industry tries to get is tries to make experts into achievers. So the next one up is an achiever, and they're well-versed in delegation. They're not particularly sensitive. They improve things departmentally. They have a little bit more complex thinking. You know, they're cognitively more complex. And then you get into the individualist, which is the next stage. And that's more of the relativistic, non-judgmental. And I suspect if Torbert were to replicate this study today, a lot more people would be in the individualist category. This was done about 10 years ago, this study. They're aware of possible conflict between principles and actions. I think you're going to find a lot more millennials bleeding into this category, even though back then it was only 10% of the population. So I think what you're trying to do in millennial leadership, kind of what I call metamodern leadership, is you're trying to, instead of going to stage 3 to 4, you want to go from stage 5 to 6, ideally, which is to kind of find yourself again, become an individualist, become non-judgmental, but not to the point where you lose your vision, your own personal vision, and then you turn into a strategist. And that's where you encourage personal and organizational transformation. So that's really where you become becoming a person who does transactions, maybe for a living or just to get things done and get out of your way, to somebody who handles transformation, and usually and hopefully, if you can help it, sort of a creative and innovative conflict resolution sort of way. I mean, that's putting all these sort of 7 P's that I call them together. Hopefully you can rise to the level of a strategist within the context of your time and place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to put another fine point on it, because I think it's so important in these kinds of conversations, these aren't like binary places like, oh, I've checked off, you know, being rational and effective, right? They actually all take kind of cultivation, and each of them is kind of like, it could be an endless game to a certain degree. You know, like Kant is on one very far end of the spectrum of like that kind of expression of human consciousness, right? Yeah, I don't know. It's much richer and more complex and more like multifaceted, I think, than these. I think these developmental models tend to indicate. And also, like, so this stage 6, like, so people who have done things like, you know, either meditated or become gone on a journey of self-discovery, like that's kind of what happens in that stage. And you can ask yourself, like, to what degree am I familiar with the previous stages? But in any case, that is seemingly the kind of a new level of leadership that's needed now to kind of meet the world as it is increasingly becoming. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think, as you develop and you develop your competencies, I guess you could call them your competencies, but it's almost like you're simultaneously developing a spiritual stage as well. Hmm. And it's almost like they go back and forth between the two dimensions, kind of like what you're saying. And that's why, like you were saying, the cover of the book, it's a depiction. And I actually I was lucky enough to have an artist do this originally, this version of the Janus, from Roman mythology. And the Janus was the god of gates or doors or transitions or something like that. Exactly how it's translated. But, it's like, man, you have to have a sort of an internal battle with yourself, as you sort of ascend into these. It's not going to be easy. You know, this is not just like you said, it's not gonna be a check mark. You're not just going to go, oh, well, now I'm going to believe this. It's like, well, you don't have any control over what you believe. Mm. You know, if you want to change your beliefs, it's going to require a lot of work.
Nice. Yeah. And I think that's a risk in these kinds of conversations, is to just name these things like they're one after another. But yeah, it does require a lot of work. And so the good news, or what you inspired me, or what struck me in our previous conversation, though, is that you see kind of corporations increasingly vectoring towards a lot of these leadership styles and sensibilities. And you made the case to me, and it was very persuasive, that like, this is actually not just the future of like weird fringe podcast philosopher land, you know, but actually the realm of like major corporations.
Right. A lot of people ask me, like, how the hell did you get into this? From you know, you're writing a book about business. How did you get into metamodern, you know, ideas about philosophy? And it's like, well, it's a long story. Just like it pretty much parallels the rest of the idea about culture. It's like, if you go back to business around the turn of when the millennials were being born, you know, you talk about the sort of the zeitgeist of the neoliberal fervor of freeing up economies across the world, and that's great because you get cheaper products and you get goods from all over the world, and man, it's great. And that was really what stopped the stagflation in the 1970s. It was the kind of the cure. So, you know, looking back, it's like, do you really blame people for implementing those ideas? And that's what the presidential election in 2016 sort of, you know, rebelled against, was this neoliberal idea that started started with Carter, and on through Reagan, and you know, on throughout Clinton, and really through Obama the whole time. So you've got and obviously business, government's behind business in general. That's the way contracts work. But you have this sort of idea of profit maximization in Wall Street, and you start to have mergers and acquisitions, and businesses doing all this new crazy stuff, because there's, you know, the idea of innovation is kind of gone, because your only innovation is to sort of offshore and to move some things around and kind of restructure, and to then the next step from that is you start to cinch the belt up, right? You start to find out what can you cut. So now you start to get into the sort of the Six Sigma ideas of, well, we're going to, you know, the lean ideas, we can cut this, and we can cut this, and we can, you know, we're bloated here, and okay, fine. But, you know, we'll cut pensions, we'll do this. But once you start getting like we are now, and like we have been for the past 5 or 10 years, once you start getting the millennial generation into the mix in your workforce, those ideas, not only does it not interest them for the most part of running a business that way, it's like, well, we're in a period where we need innovation. That's, you know, everything's technological and innovative. I mean, ask any CEO of any company, and what kind of people do they want? Do they want people who can find, you know, cost cutting? No, they want people who can innovate. They want people who have an entrepreneurial mindset, people who have connection to the new power structures to make things happen. And I think we talked about this before. There's a gentleman named Jeremy Hyman's out of Australia, wrote a book called New Power. And really, the guy, to me, from as far as I can tell, he was an activist, sort of a progressive activist that started telling companies how to adopt these new strategies. And one thing that I liked what he said is that he said, you know, you can really relate to companies in maybe the 80s or the 90s or maybe even the 2000s. It's like we were playing a game. We were playing Tetris, where if you're a company, a block's falling and it's got a funny shape and it's going to drop and you're going to have to fit it in to where it's going to go best. That's how the world worked. Well, you know, nowadays, even this short time, since we've got all this great digital technology, we can play, I hope I have this right, Minecraft.
Yeah.
Yep. Where you kind of build things from the ground up and you don't have to wait for things to fall. You don't have to sort of retrofit things into what they were in the past. You have an opportunity to build things yourself. And when you can build and when you can create, it's going to, that's where the value in businesses, especially. I mean, you know, look at the most valuable companies now. I mean, you know, your Googles and your Amazons and your, that's where, you know, Google and Amazon aren't great companies because they know where to cut the budget. It's because they know how to innovate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you're saying that that these other corporations who aren't Apple and Google and Facebook are kind of seeing now the writing on the wall as far as what the shift for them.
Yeah. Yeah. So the reason, so I work for a large company, very large company. And one of my required viewings, was watching this Jeremy Hyman's video about New Power, and he did his speech in front of executives in Dallas. So and then they put it on the internet, and it's required for everybody to watch. So you know, I see business in general really starting to wake up to these new ideas. I mean, they understand that, you know, there's got to be development. It's like, you know, maybe 5-10 years ago, it's like, well, you know, you kind of left out there hanging in the wind. I think a lot of people can relate to this who work for large companies, because the world hadn't really changed yet. Millennials, for the most part, didn't get into, and I really keep going back to millennials here, because once they get into the workforce, for better or for worse, they want a lot different things than most people do. And that's only going to grow. And what do they want? Well, they're not necessarily looking for money. They want, well, you know, they want more options to grow and create and to innovate, and exactly the things that companies want employees to have, right? So what do you do? Well, you start to develop a system or a framework or a culture or a train path or something to let these employees actualize that gets them what they want and gets you what you want.
Yeah. Well, and they also want, I think, meaning, right? They want to feel like what they're doing meaning. With their life has meaning.
That's right. That's right.
That's something that I'm also kind of curious about, how companies will respond to, like, to what degree they're willing to restructure themselves in order to amplify the meaningfulness of actually working for them. Right. And that goes from everything from like telling a new story about what it is they do. But like, it also, you know, it's hard to, there are certain things that it's very hard to do and claim it to be very meaningful in the way I think that many people are hoping for in the millennial generation. But, so, and I think what you're getting at is perhaps that, like, you know, these companies are going to want to compete to attract millennials in order to survive. And so that, you know, essentially my degree in philosophy will become valuable, right?
Well, you know, I would like to think that, you know, I really do. Yeah. And in fact, I've read a lot of, I've really dug into to that question. I find that, you know, in let's take a step back a couple years ago to colleges, to master's programs in colleges. You know, I've seen a lot lately, just recently in the past few weeks, is, you know, MBAs are declining, masters of business administration are declining. And I think a lot of the companies that were hiring MBAs maybe 5 years ago are replacing that with MFAs, Master of Fine Arts, and with philosophy students and with people who can understand systems theory and complex interdisciplinary ideas to be able to put these things together. Because, you know, with every passing day, the world gets more complex. And if you can find somebody who can develop a framework, interpret the big things, and then sort of find simplicity on the other side of that complexity, that's who you want, right? So, you know, I think that there's a lot of systems degrees that are popping up, master's degrees, leadership. I can't remember the terms on a lot of these newer degrees that I'm seeing popping up, but I do try to follow that. So to answer your question, I think that a philosophy degree is a lot more valuable than it was 10 years ago. Absolutely.
Oh yeah. Great. Yeah. And other things that you mentioned, you know, that make me very happy is things like meditation, you know, which I think, good thing to do. And then presumably you didn't say this, but like listening to podcast conversations like this too is probably a good way to get exposed to the ideas and help you you know, meet the complexity of the world in a way that's useful actually to these companies. And so that's, yeah, I'm pleased with that, that perspective on the world. I'll be transparent about it. And yeah, I think it's a helpful and optimistic kind of picture, I think, for people who aren't drawn to STEM as the kind of, you know, place that everybody gets directed to if they want to be successful, or at least it has been for a while. And so this idea of a kind of future of a more liberal arts, where liberal arts is actually quite useful, is very, very appealing to me. And I think a hopeful vision for our future.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think you have a couple views of society. Like you have a guy like an economist, like Tyler Cohen. Am I saying that right? Tyler
Cowen or Cohen? I'm not sure.
But Cowen, Cower. I think he's a Georgetown economics professor. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called Average is Over, mm-hmm. Which it's kind of a smack in the face, kind of a wake up call. It's like, hey, the new world's going to be completely libertarian, and you better get your act in order, and you know, you better get your STEM degree and figure it out. But then there's the other idea that it's like, well, you know, there seems to be an emerging kind of understanding of metamodern politics and sensibilities and value structures, where you start to become more like the Nordic countries, and start to, you know, so there's, that's kind of what the two competing value systems, and it probably and most assuredly will play out in politics. But it's definitely something to consider.
Interesting. Yeah, I appreciate that. That's not a kind of juxtaposition that I had really considered before between somebody like Tyler Cowen or Cohen and metamodernism as being these two kind of dominant value sets, even within the millennial generation. But now that you're speaking about it, that does seem to be the case. And it's going to be interesting to watch that sort of relationship unfold over time. Well, so James, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think this was a really useful way to frame the conversation. Is there anything else that you would like to say to the audience before we bring this conversation to a close?
I don't think so. I just want to thank you very much. I enjoyed it, and it was very nice talking to you.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.